The group had moved from the big house out to the quincho. Paul Cieno was kneeled down before the parrilla, which was built into one wall of the cocina, or kitchen. He worked with great effort, and as yet not much success, to get the wood that he had carefully arranged under the heavy black iron grill to catch fire. Susanna Cieno stood behind him, leaning against the polished marble countertop to the left of the parrilla, handing her husband sheets of newspaper for use as tinder. On the countertop, beside the stainless steel sink, was an impressively large wooden platter, piled high with an even more impressively large stack of a dozen lomo, each filet mignon hand-cut from tenderloins of beef to a thickness of 2 inches. Nearby were the makings for side dishes of seasoned potatoes and tossed salad. In the adjoining main room of the quincho, there was a brand-new flat-screen television mounted on a wall that was identical to the one in Nuestra Pequeña Casa. The DirecTV dish antenna on the quincho's red tile roof was identical to the one mounted on the big house. The television set in the quincho, however, was hooked to a repeater connected to the DirecTV antenna on the big house. This allowed for the antenna on the quincho roof to be aimed at an Intelsat satellite in permanent orbit some 27,000 miles above the Earth's surface, and thus to be part of a system that provided the safe house with instant encrypted voice, visual, and data communication. It communicated with similar proprietary devices at the Office of Homeland Security in the Nebraska Avenue complex in Washington, D.C., and ones in what had at one time been the post-stockade at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and was now the headquarters of Delta Force, and even more clandestine special operations forces. Most of the group was sitting in teak deck chairs that they had pulled inside from the veranda. The TV was now tuned to the English-language CNN, not because its non-stop coverage of the disaster that was Hurricane Katrina was any better than that of Deutsche Welle, it arguably was worse, but because DW was repeating ad nauseam the same footage and interviews. The on-air talent, both on location and in the various news bureaus, had long ago stopped offering any real reporting and had instead resorted to the basic equivalent of a live camera simply airing the obvious. And while it was only a matter of time before CNN's so-called in-depth coverage would begin to loop, at least for now the group was seeing and hearing something somewhat different. This same dynamic happened during the Desert Wars, Lieutenant C.G. Castillo thought with more than a little disgust. Sticking a camera crew out in the middle of a hot zone with a clueless commentator, someone with no real understanding of what's going on around them, is worse than there being no, quote, reporting, unquote, at all. Watching RPG rounds and tracers in a firefight, or people looting a flooded food store without an educated source on screen to put what you're seeing in context of the big picture, only serves to drive the hysteria. It damn sure doesn't help someone sitting in the comfort of their living room better understand what the hell is really going on. Castillo turned from the TV and glanced around the quincho. Of the people watching CNN, three could, and in fact often did, pass as Argentines. They were the Cienos, who now had the parrilla wood burning, and a 23-year-old from San Antonio, Texas, named Ricardo Soles, who had come to Argentina as an agent of the Drug Enforcement Administration. All had mastered the Porteño accent of a Buenos Aires native. Anthony J. Tony Santini, a special agent of the U.S. Secret Service, a stocky and somewhat swarthy 42-year-old, could pass for a Porteño until he had to say something, whereupon his accent usually gave him away. None of the others watching the TV in the quincho even tried to pass themselves off as Argentines. Special Agent David W. Young of the FBI, a 32-year-old of Chinese ancestry, who spoke Spanish and three other languages, none of them Oriental, felt that his race made trying to fob himself off as an Argentine almost a silly exercise. The language skills of various others were rudimentary. As Colonel Jacob D. Jake Taurine, United States Air Force, put it, "It's as if the moment I get out of the States, a neon sign starts flashing over my head. American, throw rocks!" Inspector John J. Doherty of the FBI understood what Taurine meant. Lieutenant Colonel Castillo had once remarked, "Taurine and Doherty look like somebody called Central Casting and said, 'Send us an airline pilot and an Irish cop.'" Neither had taken offense. One viewer of what Katrina was doing to New Orleans and the Gulf Coast was in a category of his own. Corporal Lester Bradley, United States Marine Corps, was not quite 20. He appeared to be about 17. He stood 5 feet 5 inches tall and weighed a little under 140 pounds. Looking at him now, attired in a knit polo shirt, khaki trousers, and red and gold striped Nike sports shoes, very few people would think of associating him with the military at all, much less with the elite special operations. The truth here was that Bradley, fresh from Paris Island boot camp, had earned his corporal's stripes as a designated marksman with the Marines on the march to Baghdad. On his return to the United States, he had been assigned to the USMC Guard Detachment at the American Embassy in Buenos Aires, where he mostly functioned as a clerk typist until the day he had been detailed as the man the gunny felt he could most easily spare to drive a GMC Yukon XL to Uruguay. 3 days after that, Bradley found himself part of a hastily organized special operations mission, during which he saved the life of then-Major C.G. Castillo by using a borrowed sniper's rifle to take out two of the bad guys with headshots. Bradley thus had learned too much about a very secret operation, and the reasons for said operation, for him to be returned to the care of the gunny, who could be counted on to demand a full account of where his young corporal had been and what he had done. So Bradley next had been aboard the aircraft on which Castillo and the body of Sergeant First Class Seymour Krantz, who had been killed during the operation, returned to the United States. Not knowing what to do with Bradley back in the States, Castillo had put him on ice at Camp McCall, North Carolina, the Special Forces training base, until he could find a solution. Camp McCall's Sergeant Major, Jack Davidson, had taken one look at the boyish Marine, concluded that his assignment to McCall was a practical joke being played on Davidson by a Marine Master Gunnery Sergeant acquaintance, and put him to work pushing the keys on a computer. The first that Davidson learned of who Bradley really was, and that he had saved the life of Castillo, with whom Davidson had been around the block many times, most recently in Afghanistan, came when Lieutenant General Bruce J. McNabb showed up at McCall to arrange for Bradley to attend Sergeant Krantz's funeral at Arlington National Cemetery.